Hey, you were so here at George Mason University. I'm here with Shelby Eisen from Northern Illinois University to discuss the article titled Another Decade of Qualitative Research in the Journal of Teaching and Physical Education. It was recently published in, and this is going to be obvious, JTPE. You can find the full site, as always, of the article in the show notes. Shelby, welcome to the podcast and thanks for coming on.
Hi, Risto. Thanks for having me today. And of course, thank you to my mentor and co-author, Kevin Richard, Michael Hentel, and Thomas Templin for showing me the ropes on this project.
Sounds good. So can you just give us an overview so everybody's on the same track, what qualitative research is, and kind of talk about the importance and limitations of that type of research?
Sure. So when researchers attempt to answer a question or solve a problem, they need a set of tools. Different tools work for different problems. The two major toolboxes researchers can pull from are quantitative and qualitative, or of course, a mixture of the two. Quantitative tools help us to quantify a phenomenon, and qualitative tools help us to describe the qualities of a phenomenon. Quantitative tools output data into numerical findings like descriptive statistics or correlations between variables, and qualitative tools, what we're talking about today, output data into words like themes, participant quotes, or images. I like to think of qualitative research as a set of tools that give us a glimpse into human perceptions, thoughts, feelings, and lived experiences. Qualitative research is important because it allows researchers to collect data in participants' natural setting. So for example, I'm interested in understanding and advancing physical education curricula. So I think one crucial aspect of achieving this vision is to go out into the schools and hear the lived experiences of teachers and their students. While collecting data in a natural environment is a benefit because we are minimizing our influence on the results as researchers, it can also be time demanding. It takes time to build the relationships with the school, teachers, and students in order to be welcomed into their environment without causing a disturbance. And additionally, in terms of time, if we're using an interview method, for example, it takes time to capture the individual stories, time to transcribe those stories into text, especially if we don't have funding for software to transcribe for us, and read and reread the transcribed stories to analyze the data.
Yeah, so a little bit longer than point and click and enter in data for sure. And I think a lot of us have been there. Okay. So why did you choose to review the qualitative research specifically in the Journal of Teaching and Physical Education?
Yeah, good question. Two main reasons. First, the JTPE is a flagship journal within our field and played a large role in legitimizing qualitative research. Within their mission statement, JTPE states that all methodological approaches are acceptable for publication. I think it's important to document the methodologies in the JTPE in terms of what they're publishing in order to keep a pulse on one of the major journals that played a role in legitimizing qualitative research in the field. Consecutive and sequential reviews could illustrate changes in publication trends and help to understand how research focus develops or changes over time within a single journal. And then secondly, my path back to PE and the PE world is a windy one. And when I joined the pedagogy lab at the University of Illinois with Kevin Richard, I was a bit rusty on all things PE and quite honestly new to the idea of research in PE. So my advisor and co-author, Kevin, had the idea of embarking on this 10-year qualitative review of the JTPE, which would serve as a follow-up to his and Dr. Hemphill's and Dr. Templin's 10-year review of the previous 10 years. They reviewed the JTPE from 1998 to 2008, and the timing of when I joined the lab sort of worked out perfectly for me to take the lead on the next 10 years, which was 2009 to 2019.
Yeah. I did a similar timing, except when I came in with Steve Silverman at Columbia, I did a 20-year review of research on teaching in PE. We had like 1,000 articles. And one thing it definitely did for me was it threw me into the deep end of the pool. I read so much and understood so much more about research. So I know, like, for you in this scenario, you're looking at 10 years of detailed JTP articles about qualitative research. So I'm sure that it definitely got your wheel spinning and kind of got you jump started. So awesome to be in that position and end up with a publication like this. So I'm wondering about.
Yeah, it's definitely a. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say it was definitely a much needed crash course on all things PE, and I really appreciated it. It really set the foundation for my degree and then now my work as a new faculty member.
Do you think that doing a study that was so in-depth in qualitative research pushed you to do more qualitative research, or were you already leaning in that way, or do you do more quantitative research? Do you think this project changed that at all?
Yeah, so I actually started my PhD in the psychophysiology lab at the University of Illinois, working with Dr. Stephen Petrozillo, and so that work was very quantitative, lab-based. And I, funnily enough, switched gears because of I took Dr. Richard's qualitative methodology class, and I still remember getting off the phone after my first interview, and I immediately texted Dr. Richards and I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize research could be this fun. Like, I just had a chat with someone is what it felt like, learned a lot from them. It was a practicing teacher that I had gotten off the phone with. And it just really opened my eyes to, you know, I 100% see the need for quantitative and qualitative. And qualitative to me just seems a lot more fun because you get to actually hear the stories, kind of like going to the movies and learning all these new stories, except now you're doing research with it. So going to Dr. Richard's lab in and of itself switched my gears to qualitative, and then doing this study that we're talking about reaffirmed that, and then also opened my eyes to, I think there is a gap in, at least I found a bit of a decline in mixed methods research. So my vision for my career is to really blend those two, and I want to continue to do mixed methods research.
Yeah. And we just had a chapter in Kevin, Michael, and Paul's book with Pam Klina and Aaron Centeio about mixed methods. And we cited a couple of the papers that you cite in this paper talking about exactly that, that mixed methods has always been this small portion, because it's tough to do. And it's tough, even like people who do mixed methods research, they tend to publish them separately, because the qualitative data is so rich that they're like, okay, well, I can get a couple articles out of this, and then I'll, you know, share the quantitative papers in this paper or these two papers or presentation. And it's really hard to do a mixed methods, like a really good tight mixed methods paper in, you know, 28 pages on a Word document, double spaced. So I can definitely see that.
Yeah, you said that perfectly.
Yeah. So let's talk about the methods of it. Can you just tell us about the design of this research? Like, how did you go about looking at 10 years of qualitative research in JTPE?
Yeah, so when I saw that there were 377 articles, which sounds small compared to your 1,000 that you talked about, but I was pretty overwhelmed with this idea of data charting in an Excel spreadsheet, because I'm super anxious about everything in life. And I'm like, well, what if I accidentally like hit the keyboard and I delete a bunch of data and I can't get it back? So I had the idea to create a Qualtrics survey that walked you through essentially all the components of a data charting tool. So, you know, using this tool just helped me feel more organized and just more natural to capture those key elements. So I developed the Qualtrics tool. We screened that with some colleagues. And then once it was ready, all the 377 articles got put into this survey, and essentially if it said that if the article had a qualitative component, it kicked the article into a series of much more in-depth questions for our data charting, where we pulled out specific things like the methodology, the theories, the participants. If it turned out that the article was theoretical or quantitative, we kind of stopped after collecting the author information and the abstract. But for the qualitative components, we captured authorship, participants, the theories, data collection methods, analysis, and trustworthiness strategies. And we selected these categories based on previous reviews. And then we did one extra thing that we wanted to extend our project with, which was try to capture some of the study's findings to bring a more practical element to the project.
Yeah, and I love that you have that, because in our review of PE teaching research for that 20 years, we did that, like the same first part with the Qualtrics, but we didn't summarize the findings, because to me it looked like, because we did a systematic review, and like to me it was just so overwhelming to think about categorizing 1,000 articles in like categories and summarizing some of them, whereas coding took enough time. And I think that's why, like, you should never do a research review of 20 years of that's that big. I mean, 377 articles that you're looking at, and you had, you know, over 100 that you actually like looked at specifically. That's still so much to like categorize and analyze and read and review. So I think people listening to this, I think, and you know, the papers before that had hundreds and hundreds of articles that are coded, it takes a lot of time. And I think I saw in that article, you said something like 150 hours between the three of you just entering that information, just a mountain of work.
Yeah. So, yeah, it definitely was a huge undertaking.
Yeah, not for the faint of heart. So let's move into the kind of results section. Overall, what direction does your research say that JTP has been kind of moving towards? Like, what are the overall trends that you uncovered in this review of research?
Yeah, so from 2009 to 2019, out of the 377 articles published, 158 of them were qualitative research. And then 118 studies were solely qualitative, and then 40 were mixed methods. 167 were quantitative, and 52 were theoretical. So overall, about 42% of articles included qualitative methods, whether it be purely qualitative or mixed. When comparing this data with the previous 10-year review, the biggest trend that caught my eye was the sheer volume increase of articles published by the JTPE. We went from 209 published in the previous decade to 377 in our decade. And at first glance, you might think that qualitative research is growing, since 110 articles included qual in the previous decade, and our decade identified 158. But when you look at this holistically, qual research actually declined by about 11%, given the volume increase in published articles. So I thought it was interesting that mixed methods research, like we talked about earlier, has almost cut in half over our review compared to the former. And then even just within our 10-year review, we saw a sharp increase in the number of articles published per year. So in 2009, JTPE published 24 articles, and then by 2019, they published 45.
Yeah, and that's I think across a lot of different journals, a lot of different fields, there's just such a volume. And I think it's because we're expected to do a lot more in publishing. But those are interesting stats for sure. And I'm wondering if you can discuss the different reasons, the implications and suggestions that you discussed in your study related first, like, to the descriptive results.
Okay. I'll kind of bracket this out into a couple categories. So for research design specifically, the majority of qualitative articles actually didn't state their overarching qualitative design. About 86 articles didn't state their overarching design. And then 14 different designs were stated, and the top two were case study, cited 35 times, and interpretivism, which was cited 9 times. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of who was publishing, there were 269 unique authors contributed to the 158 qualitative containing articles. It was pretty evenly split among males and females. There were 131 females and 138 males. And then in terms of countries, the majority came from the U.S., 65%, Then the second highest authorship country was Australia, with Canada and the UK tied for third. And then the main theories that have been used, 36 studies didn't cite a theory, which means 122 did. And then of those, occupational socialization theory was the most cited with 27 articles. And the second most used was constructivism, 15 articles. And third was the social ecological model. In terms of methods that have been used to conduct the research, the average study used two different data collection methods, qualitative specifically. Interviews were used 133 times, so it's definitely the largest. And then within interviews, semi-structured interviewing was the most common. Document analysis was the next used with 86 times, and reflective writing was the most common. And observations were the third most used, which was 79 times. And non-participatory observations were the most common. And then open-ended surveys came up 18 times. Next, in terms of the target population being researched, 22% included participants from multiple categories, and categories meaning like teachers, students, pre-service teachers, and faculty members. Those are the main target population. Most were teachers. 64 articles had the population being teachers. K through 12 students were in 39 articles. Pre-service teachers were also 39, and then faculty members were in 22 articles. So, but overall, to kind of tie that up, 36 articles were looking at participants from multiple of these categories. I would say the one thing that stands out to me within the population being researched was it was disappointing to see that participant ethnicity was only reported in 59 or 37% of those studies. And then lastly, the author's trustworthiness strategies. 20 articles did not reference trustworthiness. Most studies, 121 of them, included multiple methods for trustworthiness. And the most commonly cited were member checking and qualitative triangulation. They are both cited 88 times. Coming in at 85 times were peer debriefing. 54 times was analyst triangulation. 50 times with negative case analysis, and then 27 times with audit trail.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that sticks out to me, like the idea that only 36 studies didn't report a theory whatsoever, which is, you know, I think in quantitative research or mixed methods research, sometimes you can get away with not talking about theory, but qualitative research is so embedded in theory. And so it's interesting that they are published, and we saw this as well, and it was probably about a similar number that we saw in our latest after-school program review that didn't talk about it. But a lot of those were also quantitative papers, and I think the K to 12 students as being target population in 39 out of the 158 articles, like that just shows that it's hard to get into school districts and get, and that's how I interpret it, at least, that, you know, it's much harder to get consent and assent from minors than it is to work with teachers, you know, and getting into school districts is hard, and going to observe, and, you know, if you're doing videotape analysis or something like that, or videotaping, audio taping interviews, and, you know, those are just the extra steps that are super tough to do. And you know,
yeah.
So even with the trustworthiness, you know, the top way that people or researchers presented trustworthiness was through member checking. And I understand that the range of this was 2009 to 2019, but, you know, like the recent article, I think it's like 2017, Smith and McGannon article talked about like how member checking is not the gold standard, like you should not do a member check. There would be other ways that are much better to include your participants in qualitative research to add rigor. Just sending, and I have done this for sure, like I've sent the transcript over and said, can you look this over and let me know if I missed anything? And I say, trustworthiness, check. They had the opportunity to speak back to the data, but they never saw the way I analyzed it, the way I presented their thoughts and how I perceived them.
So I feel like there's a lot there, and it's really, really interesting. Is there anything that you felt like out of those descriptive categories that kind of stuck out to you?
Yeah, I actually the one that you hit on first with the research on students,
mm-hmm.
and it ties back to what we talked about earlier in this idea of like a publisher perish culture in academia. And you know, it's interesting that over the last decade and beyond, we're seeing less mixed methods work, which we said, you know, it can be for multiple reasons, whether it's hard to fit into a paper, but it's also very time consuming.
Yeah.
And you need a large range of skill sets or a diverse team.
Yeah.
And then we're also seeing an increase in the theoretical work, which while theory is very hard and it takes a lot of thought, it doesn't involve us going out into a school and getting all those check boxes like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe there's a kind of a theme going on here that if academia keeps putting a lot of pressure on researchers to publish to get things like tenure, promotion, then, you know, are we going to continue to see less people going out into the schools because of how much time it takes to work with those students and, you know, not being able to meet those demands for publishing in order to hit the check boxes for tenure?
Yeah, absolutely. And then figuring out when you're like, okay, if I'm going to do a really in-depth study that's a year or 2 years long and gather a lot of rich data, do I have enough to publish before my third year review? Do I have enough to publish before I go up for tenure if I'm starting it after my third year review? Will I get those papers in publication versus, the papers count for the same amount in the eyes of administration usually. If you're publishing in JTPE, a quantitative or a qualitative paper, they don't always look at the nuance of like, that was a 2 year study that got published in there, or that was a cross sectional study, or even a research note. Like it's pretty much the same credit wise for tenure and promotion. So,
wondering. Yeah, exactly. I think we need a new system for giving credit or like points towards research where a longitudinal study or a study that involves interviewing students, maybe that gets a little more merit on the tenure track sheet if you're a teacher educator.
Yeah, absolutely. So you categorize the qualitative research into six themes. So this is kind of like the second part of your findings. Can we go through each of those? It would be great if you could kind of summarize the findings and share what were your main suggestions regarding where research is going and how research can kind of move the field forward. And so there are six themes, and maybe we can just go one by one with those.
Sure. First, just as kind of like a blanket statement about this section, we talked about this a little bit earlier as well with, you know, how huge of an undertaking it is to try to dive into a qualitative component within this larger, like, descriptive tenure study. So I kind of view this section of the study as a launch point for future research. We wanted to capture the type of qualitative research being conducted over the past 10 years in hopes that it might shed light on topics being studied, and in doing so, prompt readers to identify gaps in what's being studied across the themes. Honestly, if we were to do this study again in another 10 years, this is the area I'd like to rethink the most. In my gut, I feel like there needs to be more practical application messages in the work that we do. I just don't know that I know the best way to synthesize those practical nuggets quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'll dive into that first category, which is research on teachers. So this theme focused on in-service physical education teachers regarding their socialization, their beliefs, experiences working in the schools, and I'll pull out the, like, here's what we know and here's what I think we need to know more about, just to synthesize these sections. So here's what we know about research on teachers. Physical education teachers learn best during professional development when it's hands-on. They are taught without being told exactly what to do in a prescriptive manner. So they still have the autonomy to make decisions. And instruction, they also learn best when instruction meets the varying needs for levels of understanding and support. I think what we need to know more about is reshaping teaching to meet the needs of cultural competency, gender equity, marginalization, and physical literacy.
Mm-hmm. So what about the research on students?
Yeah, so this theme included studies focused on youth and physical education and activity settings, as well as students enrolled in college physical activity courses. We know that student learning is most likely to occur in settings where teachers engage students through lessons that were meaningful to them and help students positively impact their own health behaviors. I'd like to see more articles published that talk about the specific strategies teachers use to motivate and engage their students. And how do we understand the factors that influence students' self-concept? You know, there's a lot of pieces within physical education, especially at the secondary levels, that might, you know, put a student off before they even enter the gymnasium, before they even hear their teacher speak. Just the idea of changing in a locker room is daunting. So I think we need to understand more about those factors that influence their self-concept, that we can tailor physical education classes in a way that respects their self-concept and allows them to enjoy movement at all ages.
Yeah. And as you're saying these, I'm thinking this is good. This is a great section for like doctoral students or early career researchers looking at like, what's the next question? Well, if you go back to the section in your paper, you're going to find a lot of things because you do a really good job like pushing the, like, what do we need to know more about? So speaking of, what about the third part, which was the research on teaching?
Yeah, and thank you for that, by the way. But for research on teaching, we know administrator support leads to higher quality physical education teaching. We know administrators should involve PE teachers in decisions about professional development and instructional delivery. And that pedagogical change may only be possible when teachers' values and pedagogical perspectives are aligned with the subject of their learning. I think we need to know more about the written curriculum that teachers are implementing within their classes.
Yeah, for sure. What about PEAT, like teacher education research? What did you find there?
Yeah, we know field experiences provide benefits to pre-service teachers. I think we need to learn more about how to provide pre-service teachers with field experiences or comprehensive school physical activity programs. And I think we need to know more about how PEAT programs and K-12 PE are evolving together. I think we need more collaboration between the two. So as PEAT students graduate and enter the schools, what are the gaps? What didn't we prepare them for? And can PEAT programs work alongside schools to help with professional development for teachers, like we talked about in the research on teachers section?
So almost like, can the PEAT program continue to be the center for professional development in that local community for alumni or for just general teachers? I love that. And I love the gaps piece of like, you know, what do we still need to do? Because that was our conversation with a lot of our education colleagues just yesterday about that same exact issue. So what about the fifth one?
Yeah, I like the alumni. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, and I got that.
I just wanted to add, I
got that from somebody told me when I was back at Cal State Fullerton that this was like the British model, and I could be wrong, but they had these like professional development things that the alumni would come back to campus at the end of the semester to see the group of graduating seniors off, and they would also be coming in for professional development at that point. And we did a little bit of that at Cal State Fullerton before I left, that we'd have two professional development sessions that our teachers would provide. At Mason, we do a lot more at the state conference. We provide that. We do some professional development, which, again, in the last 3 years, it's just been so weird. So we haven't done it as much. But, you know, pre-COVID, we did a lot of professional development for the local school districts. So, you know, Fairfax County or Arlington or Prince William County, and we do a couple sessions for them. And I think that PEAT programs can become like a really good key area for professional development for not just our alumni, but just the teachers around in this area for sure.
Yeah, I love that. I need to look more into this British model. Feel free to send me any articles you have.
Wow, no articles. That, it's all just
hearsay. I think that's a brilliant idea.
It's all just hearsay, so we'll see. So your fifth one was
we can put it into a theoretical article.
Exactly. We just have to find the British person.
I was going to say, we can put it into it. Yeah. Yep.
So the fifth one was research on policy, programming, and advocacy. What was that all about?
So this theme included studies focused on how policies guide physical education and physical activity development, implementation, and refinement. Similar to what we were just talking about, a key factor of curricular success is the working relationship between universities and physical education programs. As universities create or redefine policies related to physical education, teacher education, curricula. And I'm blanking now, but I want to say, was it Lawson that had an article published during my PhD, and he was a guest speaker over Zoom for one of my classes, mm-hmm. that talked about this idea of PE and PEAT evolving together. Yeah. And that was really just like this aha moment in my mind of like, yeah, how are we going to make sure that we evolve together? And just a question that I think we need to unpack a little bit more.
Absolutely. And the last one, the sixth theme, is research on teacher educators. So research on people like you and me. So what was that last one about?
Yeah, so some of the biggest things we noticed as a central theme was that we know doctoral education and the relationship someone has with their advisor plays a large role in their decision to pursue a career as a faculty member and become involved in professional organizations. And even just like you and I were talking about earlier, you know, our decisions of which studies to embark on in terms of even this project is influenced by our advisors. So that relationship is a key factor. Socialization also influences whether future teacher educators develop more conservative or innovative orientations towards physical education. And we know faculty priorities and program methods of teacher preparation do vary greatly. And personally, especially as a new faculty member, I'd like to see more work published on the methods teacher educators use alongside how it translates to pre-service teachers' abilities once they enter student teaching and then longitudinally throughout their career. Kind of going back to what we were talking about on research on teacher education, I had a meeting recently with an administrator and was just kind of picking their brain about, like, you know, from your perspective, the ones responsible for the hiring and continual training of PE teachers at a large suburban district, I just asked her, you know, what is it that you see students are lacking, and not students, from my perspective, students, but our teachers that are graduating going into their schools, like, mm-hmm. what do the schools see as a lacking skill? Like, where can we kind of fill the gaps to make sure that we're preparing teachers to be ready for the schools that they're entering?
Right. Yeah. So did they give you any like super good insight? And because we asked that question, we meet with the local school district personnel, right? So the head of PE and all the local like 6 to 8 school districts. And we asked that question, and it's interesting to get the answers of what it is, because it varies from different people, you know, and I think we do a good job. I'm very biased of our own program, of course, but I think we do a really good job in producing teachers. But I'm wondering, are there things that you've heard that teachers are lacking in general that are coming in?
Yeah, so their direct response was they would like teachers that are ready to train high school students specifically, so just talking about high school here, mm-hmm. People with more background in group fitness instruction and personal training, mm-hmm. because this idea of helping K-12 students, specifically high school students, maybe get some tangible skills that they can take into a career-ready college program, or even just something that they can get a certification in and become and get a part-time job during high school or after high school would be really helpful. So group fitness instruction, training, and then personal training. But, and again, I have a huge bias here because this is what my background is in. Mm-hmm. So maybe the administrator also knew my background. So yeah. I don't know if that played a role at all or not.
No, but I think that that's, I mean, the high schools around here, like the elective classes they have are personal fitness, yoga, strength training, you know, so like it's definitely moving towards there in a lot of areas. And I don't know, like if, and you talked about Lawson's comment about evolving together, right? I think the schools are evolving and they are changing. And again, it might not be what all the researchers are saying that we should go to or they want to go to, but those are the things that are offered. For instance, like yoga at this local high school down the street, huge high school. They have one class now. They're going to add a second one because it's 100% full. And we're not teaching students in our program to teach yoga, like at all. Like it doesn't come up anywhere. But if they would get a 200-hour yoga certification throughout their, you know, school, their undergraduate, they would be a good hire for that school. But we're not doing that. And I think, you know, we have a strength and conditioning kind of class, like a pedagogy of strength and conditioning, but that's one semester. And compared to field and evasion games, you know, net and target games, dance and rhythmic gymnastics kind of stuff, like that overweighs a lot of that. But also we do a K-12 license. So if you don't know how to do games and activities, you're not going to do strength and conditioning for second graders. So it has to be balanced, but I'm not sure if it's balanced enough. And it takes a long time for a PEAK program to move, to adapt.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And one of my personal, you know, big pie in the sky visions would be that, like the high school close to you that is seeing this growth in yoga classes. And, you know, what if high schools then took it a step further and offered honors courses in physical education? And now after taking the prerequisite of yoga one or even yoga two, now what about offering like becoming a yoga instructor? And now it's just more rigorous, like teaching students about what they need to be an instructor. Yeah. So that maybe they can do that, you know, after they're of appropriate age and want to get a part-time job. But like we were talking about, for a PE teacher to do that, they of course need to have really strong skills in those areas. And one of the things I love about PE is there's so many ways to move our bodies, and it doesn't really matter which way we do it as long as we move. So it's hard when you think about PE programs, you know, how do you specialize on certain movements? So another thing that bounces around in my head with all the other million things that bounce around in there is, you know, will one day we need to have PE programs that specialize, like, oh, I'm a graduating high school student and I really want to be strong in group fitness. So I want to seek out this university that's known for training their PE teachers that specialize in this. Or I really want to focus on sport development. So I want to seek out this program across this country. So, you know, just some food for thought.
That is some food for thought. So let me ask you one final question as we kind of wrap this up. You suggested that a future literature review could consider a paradigm or theory to position their study for readers. Can you expand on that as we kind of wrap it up?
Yeah, like we talked about earlier, we were pretty surprised by how many studies in our review did not include theory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, traditionally, theory has been a central component of the research plan for qualitative research. It grounds the work in context, and it helps to build more understanding within a specific topic. I'm a big hater on the, that's the way it's done, but that's what we will continue to do, school of thought. So I'm not saying that all research needs to adopt a theory. I just think that if scholars aren't going to align with a theory or aren't attempting to build new theory, they should at least be providing justification for why theory isn't used.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Thank you very much for coming on. I loved reading it. I think it's a really solid
example of a good review paper for those people who are doing review papers. And I also really highly suggest doing this at the time that you, Shelby, did this and the time that I did this, because as we're going through this and you're reading, you're getting so much more information, but it also helped me become such a better reviewer because I coded hundreds of articles and I understood what things like people were missing. Like when I looked at, these are the things that you need to have. So like my template that starts with my paper starts with all those things that I learned. Trustworthiness and credibility, is validity and reliability, and do they acknowledge IRB? Have you presented this and this? And so like, you know, I think even earlier you talked about the methods of people not saying if it was a case study or an interpretivist type of study, they just didn't explain it. Like those are the things that now from your position doing this research, you'll never not add because you'll see glaringly like, oh, that's, you should have that. So I really appreciate you sharing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And like you said, I'm not quite at the reviewer stage being so early and as a faculty member, but I can see how that will be helpful when I get to that stage. And for me right now, it's done leaps and bounds for my ability to write, because just like you mentioned, I know which key component I should be hitting on and where they're placed within the paper. So yeah, I agree. It was such a empowering project for me to take on during my PhD.
Yeah, awesome. Well, and full disclosure, I'm an associate editor for JTPEs, and I just heard you that you're not reviewing a lot for JTPEs, so I'll be sending my qualitative articles down to you. So thanks, Shelby. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And so for those of you who want to read the full article, you can check out the full citation in the notes section. And I also want to thank Alba Rodriguez for her help in producing these podcasts. Thanks.